Hey, did you know Voice America has partnered with the Kidstar Network to expand their reach through Voice America Kids? Voice America Kids will feature talk radio for kids by kids, along with special event programming and live broadcasts. Each program is conveniently archived for on-demand listening at any time. Please check our archives for the latest events and happenings on voiceamericakids.com.
If you think you've seen online TV before, let us surprise you.
VoiceAmerica.tv is online now.
The leader in live internet talk radio has done it again. Multiple channels, a state-of-the-art viewing experience, live and on-demand programs streaming 24 hours a day. It's exactly what you want, when you want it.
VoiceAmerica.tv.
From health and wellness to business, sports, and everything in between. Discover our new world. Visit VoiceAmerica.tv now and experience the future of online television.
VoiceAmerica.tv.
If you're one of the lucky few that never have to worry about your position, or you just prefer to work for someone else, this message is not for you. If you are worried about future job markets, would like an opportunity to add full-time revenue to your bottom line for part-time work, or have ever wanted to own your own business, you'll want to hear this. Johnny B's Entertainment, the leader in mobile disc jockey entertainment for Arizona over the past 25 years, is expanding its operation nationally and would like to discuss your market's potential for expansion with you as a local owner. Whether economic times are good or bad, people will continue to get married, have birthdays, anniversaries, and corporate parties that require an entertainer. And Johnny B's can provide everything to get you set up with your own exclusive area, including the know-how for you to become profitable almost immediately. Call 1-888-282-8220 or go to johnnybs.net. That's johnnybs.net. Or call 1-888-282-8220 for answers on how you can acquire a turnkey operation in an exciting and lucrative industry today.
Tune in to the Voice America Variety Channel on the Voice America Talk Radio Network. Voice America Variety broadcasts a diverse array of topics, reaching a global community. Our experts come from all walks of life, and the topics they discuss are everything from current events, arts and entertainment, leadership, parenting, relationships, self-improvement, career advice, and a variety of other topics. Check us out today. You're sure to find something of interest. Voice America Variety. Talk on today's hot topics.
Go behind the scenes of what you see, hear, and read on the news. Learn the ins and outs of public relations on Stars of PR with Cindy R. every Thursday at 7 a.m. Pacific Time. Cindy Rakowitz is a Clio Award winner and founder of Rock and Roll Public Relations, who wants to share her PR experiences and knowledge with you. Learn how to handle a crisis, deal with celebrities, and become a terrific PR executive. Listen to the Stars of PR with Cindy R. every Thursday at 7 a.m. Pacific Time here on News Talk Radio, VoiceAmerica.com.
Think of the world 50 years ago. Now think of this same world and how it'll be 50 years from now. Did you know that if the world's population continues to grow at its current rate, our children and grandchildren will only have 25% of the resources per capita that our parents and grandparents had? We must preserve the foundation of a quality standard of living. That foundation starts with Go Green Radio. Join your host, Jill Buck, for Go Green Radio every Friday at noon Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific on Voice America.
Are you tired of the government squandering your tax dollars on bailouts and overpaid bureaucrats? On Free Markets with Dr. Mike Beitler, Mike Beitler and his guests explain why big government regulations are the problem and innovative businesses and free markets are the solution. Listen to Free Markets with Dr. Mike Beitler, Thursday mornings at 10 a.m. Eastern Time, 7 a.m. Pacific.
The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
time for Capital Thinking, where we analyze the key policy, political, legal, and business issues that will shape America's future. Live from Washington, D.C., this is your unfiltered tour of the halls of power. Now, here's your host, Kevin O'Neill.
All right, good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to Capital Thinking. We've got an all-policy show for you today. We're going to talk a little bit with one of the budget gurus about what's going to happen in the Super Committee this month, as well as talk to an employment lawyer about the Herman Cain allegations and what you can do about sexual harassment in the workplace. But we're going to spend the first half hour recapping one of the major policy initiatives in Washington, D.C. this year, and that is the passage of a free trade agreement between the United States of America and Korea. And joining us, two special guests, Senator Trent Lott, the former Senate Majority Leader, Republican from the state of Mississippi, spent 35 years in Congress, one of the handful of people who's ever served in a leadership position in both the House of Representatives and the Senate, and someone who has a great deal of experience on all sides of passing these free trade agreements, both in his time in Congress and now out of Congress, and also Frank Simolas, who heads up the international trade practice at Patton Boggs. So, Senator, welcome to your maiden voyage here on Capital Thinking. Frank, welcome back. I know the free trade agreement. This is perhaps the largest free trade agreement since President Clinton passed NAFTA when you were in Congress, Senator Lott. So tell us a little bit about why this is such a big deal for American companies.
Well, of course, I was in the Senate when we passed the NAFTA free trade agreement and worked with President Clinton on making that happen. It was a bipartisan vote, just as this vote was on the South Korea free trade agreement. In fact, the vote, once it was sent up to Congress by the President, they moved it in a historically very short period of time, about 10 days, and it passed the Senate 83-15 and the House of Representatives 278-151. This is clearly a very important trade agreement. Exports in America are very, very important. A lot of people think, well, this is really about imports. It's about exports. It's about trying to get our agriculture products and our automobiles and our heavy equipment into that very large South Korean market, which is a very large one. And the estimates are that this could mean $10 to $11 billion of additional exports going to South Korea alone. So this was a major achievement. It will allow us to see some economic growth as a result of it. We'll be able to provide more affordable goods and services for Americans, and it really opens up a number of markets in South Korea that we didn't have access to before.
Frank, I want to go back to something Senator Lott said and ask you to walk us through the nuts and bolts of this. He said it's not just about imports coming from Korea, it's about our ability to export. So explain to us some of the meaningful advantages that we get by the passage of this free trade agreement.
Sure, happy to. Just to put this in perspective, Senator Lott mentioned it's the biggest trade agreement since NAFTA, which is correct, but it's also bigger than the nine prior free trade agreements combined. This is a trillion-dollar economy, Korea. It's the seventh largest trading partner of the United States. And not only is it going to increase exports, it'll increase U.S. jobs. The conservative estimates, Kevin, are it's going to increase about 70,000 jobs in the United States. Some of the estimates go well over 100,000, close to 120,000. Keep in mind that the opportunities in Korea exist because the tariffs, the average tariffs in Korea, were much higher than they were in the United States. On manufactured goods, roughly double. So while our average is 3.2%, in Korea it was 6.6%. So when you eliminate those tariffs, and the discrepancies are much higher on agricultural goods, you create immediate market access, you create more production, and you create more jobs.
Very good. Well, Senator, you're, as we mentioned at the top of the show, you've got a great deal of experience in the House and the Senate on these agreements working their way through Congress and on the development of them when the administration would be negotiating with various countries. There have to be some things that surprised you about how this free trade agreement got to the finish line.
Well, first of all, it took about 5 years to get it there. This was actually agreed to back in the Bush administration, and it's been languishing for ever since because it did get tied up with two other trade agreements that were also approved, one with Colombia and one with Panama. Unfortunately, they became intertwined, and the former Speaker of the House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi, did not want to move them, and so they languished for years. And then even in the new Obama administration, it took a great deal of time and basically some renegotiations to get some more markets opened up. But finally, when it was submitted by the president to the Congress, it moved just so expeditiously. And I think credit goes to the leadership in the House and in the Senate. Speaker Boehner kept his word. It was historic, frankly, also, that the trade agreement was approved. And the next day, the president of Korea addressed a joint session of Congress. So Dave Camp, the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, did excellent work. David Dreyer, the chairman of the Rules Committee in the House, moved it expeditiously. In the Senate, Max Baucus did his usual good job in working with the Republicans to move these trade agreements quickly. And then Harry Reid, to his credit, as the majority leader in the Senate, said publicly that, frankly, he didn't really like these trade agreements, but he put it on the schedule, and it moved through expeditiously. So once the trigger was pulled, I thought Congress, on both sides of the aisle and both sides of the Capitol, did a really good job.
Well, Frank, I want to unpack some of the senator's comments there about the bipartisan cooperation. That's not something we see a whole lot of in Washington these days. Were there particular blocks of folks in the House and Senate that had to have concerns addressed in getting this free trade agreement passed?
Yes, it really came down to an agreement between the leadership in both parties. It goes back to 4 years ago when the senator mentioned the agreement was first signed. There was a agreement between Speaker Pelosi at that time and the Republican leadership to come up with a common framework for trade agreements involving labor and environmental issues that was generally agreed to back in May of 1977. When we came into the Obama administration, again, it was an agreement negotiated by the Bush administration. The White House added some additional elements with respect to automobiles, and that was huge in getting the support of a number of Midwestern Democrats in particular, but also Republicans. And it also brought on board for the first time labor unions that actually came out in support of a free trade agreement. First time that's ever happened. If you go back to the days of NAFTA, you know, we weren't anywhere close to that. So once you had labor and you had the leadership of both parties agreeing in principle, it wasn't easy. There was a lot of disagreements on some of the technicalities, but that's what really caused the breakthrough.
And let me just say, Kevin, it was a procedural maze because you had not only the South Korean free trade agreement, you had the other two free trade agreements, and we had other unrelated trade issues, the authority of the president, for instance, to use the so-called fast track to get a direct up-down vote. All of that was interrelated to this. And for the leadership, particularly the effort of Chairman Camp, to come up with a way to get the Senate to act in a way that the House was comfortable with and move it all through in 10 days was a very impressive effort.
And Senator, I go back to some things you said earlier, the economic effects of passing this. You know, NAFTA, even all these years later, sometimes gets attacked for having jobs move offshore out of the United States. But obviously jobs are a critical political issue right now. How do you see that the politics for both parties being helped by the passage of this free trade agreement?
Well, as Frank has already pointed out, this is estimated that it would support as many as 60 or 70,000 additional jobs for workers producing goods and services here in America that will be shipped to South Korea. South Korea does have a very large market there. Their services market is $580 billion, and they've got a huge economy. So, and so many of our products in America, they may be piece parts, may come from South Korea or from China or wherever, but then it comes to America, it's assembled, it's turned into furniture, it's a part of our production over here, and it's complementary of each other. And while there are those that are still saying, oh, we shouldn't have these trade agreements, we should basically build a fence around our country and just do everything internally, whether we like it or not, it's a global economy. And our economy is affected by what happens, obviously, in the European Union, or in oil prices, what's going on in Africa, as well as the ability to benefit from the goods and services to and from South Korea.
Frank, let me ask you to tag on. Anything else you wanted to add there about the economic impact?
Yes, a couple of things. Number one, in contrast to NAFTA, obviously we don't have any common border with Korea, and so there won't be any jobs being shipped halfway around the world.
No Ross Perot with giant sucking sounds coming from
that's right.
In fact, it will
be the reverse of that. You have a country in Korea that has very high labor agreements and standards. They have very active unions. They also have very strict environmental laws. So this is a country that is pretty much a co-equal with the United States, and you are not going to have those economic imbalances from the beginning.
And let me just point out, too, one of the things that was a sticking point was the automobile industry. And after some additional agreements were reached, the UAW union did support it. But people need to also remember that two of the major automobile manufacturers in America now are Hyundai and Kia, and they're producing a quality product. But we've had trouble getting our Fords and our General Motors products into South Korea. With this agreement, you will see a significant increased opportunity there.
You know, I think that's a great point. I think people here in the United States, they just have a hard time comprehending how big an economy Korea is and how important it is that we be able to open markets to our best valued products. You mentioned obviously automobiles. I know agriculture, that was a very big issue for us, getting beef for export. I know it was something important to Senator Baucus, I think you might have mentioned. But we're going to take a break here and come back after the break and keep talking to Senator Lott and Frank Simolas, talking a little bit about the ins and outs of how this free trade agreement got to the White House for signature by Barack Obama, what it means for various industries, and what it means for the long-term political implications of both political parties. We'll be back in just a minute. Keep it here on Capital Thinking.
Stocks, bonds, investment opportunities, financial news, and talk. We can help. Call us now toll-free, 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has 46 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
It's all about action.
Scores.
Taking a look at the NBA tonight.
Highlights.
He's broken loose. He's at the 30.
And headlines.
Big trade in the NFL this afternoon.
When you are looking to talk sports, look no further than the Voice America Sports Network. We bring you some of the biggest names and all the sports news you can handle. Whether it's basketball.
Off the glass.
Football.
Come on.
Golf. Racing. Or the Olympics. We've got you covered. We'll even cover tailgating. Tune in to the Voice America Sports Network. It's all things sports.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs. Straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
Live
from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back, everybody. We are having a fascinating discussion with former Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott and Frank Simolas, the head of the International Trade Practice at Pattenboggs, about the free trade agreement recently signed between the United States and Korea, and that passed both chambers of Congress and that President Obama has signed into law. Guys, I want to go back and ask you a little bit about the work you've done with the Korean ambassador and the embassy. You all were working with them. Tell us about the allies that you had in pushing this to passage, and give us a little inside scoop on what was happening there.
Well, if I might just jump in, Frank, I do think we need to give some credit to Pattenboggs' senior partner, Tommy Boggs. He has a very strong relationship with Ambassador Han, and he also has a long-term relationship with a number of the people in the administration, including at the White House, people like Bill Daley and Pete Rouse. And so the involvement of the ambassador was very aggressive, very strong, and we were on the phone with him many, many times, had meetings with him, with Speaker Boehner, and his entire staff really provided us the intelligence information we needed to be helpful to them. But also the president's direct involvement and concern and desire to get this treaty agreed to, and then have an opportunity to speak to a joint session with Congress to renew once again the importance of our relationship with South Korea and the United States, how long it's been going on, and how important freedom and democracy is to him and to their country. The combination of the president's role and the ambassador role and Tommy Boggs' role was very impressive. I must say, I was pleased to be a part of the team.
Very good, Frank.
Well, I would just add, the senator's absolutely right. The ambassador and the entire embassy was a terrific client to represent on this effort. We coordinated all of our strategy and thinking on a weekly basis with the embassy and their diplomats. But in the larger context, we also had a number of players in Washington, a number of industries that stood to win by market access, a lot of agricultural interests, farm groups, commodity groups, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the service industries, financial industries, insurance industries. All of these stand to win,
yes,
stand to get more market access and more jobs, were also great coordinators with us in the effort.
Senator, you mentioned in the last segment that the timing of this worked out where the agreement passed Congress and the next day the Korean president addressed a joint session of Congress. I know you've traveled literally around the globe and met with dozens if not hundreds of world leaders. But tell us what an honor it is for that Korean president to get the chance to address a joint session, especially so close to a historic event like that.
Well, it was a tremendous honor for him, and it was a very celebratory occasion. The speakers of the House generally don't invite every foreign dignitary that comes to the country to address a joint session. In fact, it's usually no more than two or three in a year. And I know that Speaker Boehner has been very careful about that, but Speaker Boehner and his chief of staff worked at the White House and the Bush administration were very open. They wanted to have the joint session, but of course there was a concern about the timing. And they had indicated for a year that they wanted to have the president speak to a joint session, but it at one point, 2 weeks out, it didn't look like it might happen. But they went ahead and extended the invitation when the process was put in place before the actual passage. So this was a really a procedural a great achievement, and it was truly an honor for our allies and for the president of South Korea, and he did an excellent job in his speech.
Frank, let me turn to you for a nuts and bolts question. So the president signed it. Has the free trade agreement taken effect? And if not, what remains to be done to get us there?
No, that's a good question, Kevin. It's not yet in effect. Keep in mind that in addition to the United States, Korea has to approve the agreement. We're confident they will, but their National Assembly, which is a unicameral body, has to vote to finally approve the agreement. We expect, Kevin, that will happen this month. And that's still not the end of the story. That means both countries have passed the legislation. They then need to make sure that all of the regulations from both countries and all of the commitments made in those agreements have been lived up to by both countries. Eventually, the President of the United States must certify that that Korea is fully in compliance with all of its commitments. All the regulations are in place. Typically, that process takes several months. The Koreans would like to have it in effect by January 1st. That is very aggressive and very optimistic, but I think, Kevin, we should realistically expect in the next 3 or 4 months we will have an agreement in effect and the markets will be open.
Well, then let's fast forward to election 2012, and Senator Lott, you got some great political instincts. Tell us a little bit about what this means for future Congresses looking at free trade agreements, but also what it means for both political parties and for the president's reelection.
Well, to be perfectly honest, there are a lot of people in this city and a lot of experts in trade and foreign policy issues that are concerned about the current status of trade negotiations. The world negotiations have pretty much collapsed, and there's even sort of a stalemate right now in terms of more bilateral negotiations of treaties. So there's a concern about, will the world drift back to, something as bad as the old Smoot-Hawley law that got us into a world trade war. And so I'm concerned about that. And I do think the presidential election will be critical. President Obama has not indicated that he wants a fast-track authority going forward yet. I think that, our Republican nominee will probably be more inclined to be supportive of U.S. involvement in worldwide trade. So this is a critical time. But right now, this is the last of the trade agreements that's pending. And so there's going to have to be a lot of thought and a lot of work done in this area going forward.
And Frank, what about you? I know you know well sort of the nuts and bolts that the actual negotiators go through to get to these agreements. Do they sort of perk up knowing that their hard work gets rewarded at the end of the day, even if it takes 5 years?
Well, they do, Kevin. And the fact is that if the United States chooses not to do anything, that doesn't mean our competitors aren't moving ahead of us. Korea is a good example. As recently as 2003, we were Korea's largest trading partner. As the senator said, this agreement took 4 years to be approved, and since 2003, we are number four in terms of trading partners with Korea. We're behind China. We're behind Japan. Now we're behind the EU that signed a free trade agreement with Korea that went into effect back in July. So I think as the world goes forward and other countries are ending these agreements, there's a tremendous degree of pressure for the U.S. and the trade negotiators to continue the momentum, whether it's bilaterally or multilaterally.
Senator, let me ask you a foreign policy question. Does the free trade agreement, how do you see that impacting Korean relations with their North Korean neighbor? As Korea gets wealthier, does that sort of ratchet up the pressure on North Korea? And how does that impact also our relations with China?
Well, you would think that maybe it would ratchet up the pressure, but of course, North Korea is such an insular and difficult to understand country, and what the people are enduring there is unfathomable. I know the South Koreans worry about this, think about it, and work on it every day. But it also it's important we have good trading relations with China and with South Korea, and they with each other. And so I think I'm one of those that believes if you're trading and if you're talking, you're probably not fighting. And so we should continue to focus on this approach as we deal with that very important part of the world.
Frank?
Well, the one thing I would add, Kevin, is that there is one set of negotiations going on now called the TPP. That stands for Trans-Pacific Partnership. In fact, President Obama is going to preside over a TPP session as part of the APEC summit coming up next week. That will integrate a lot of Asia into a broader agreement. It will take some of the agreements we've already reached with countries like Australia and Singapore and Peru and Chile, for that matter, and come up with a regional agreement that will hopefully have the U.S. moving towards a direction of, as the senator said, greater involvement in Asia, because that's where so much of our future for exports lies.
Gotcha. Well, I want to come back to one question from earlier, which was basically who benefits. We've talked about the auto industry both ways, the senator making the point about Hyundai and Kia, their presence here in the country, and the ability for the big three automakers to export successfully now to Korea. And we talked a little bit about agriculture, but I'm wondering, I know that South Korea has a blossoming technology sector. Do you see some benefits for our technology industry under this free trade agreement?
Yes, I think there are going to be lots of opportunities with respect to manufacturing in Korea and also the export of some key components that are made in the United States that go to Korea. It's really an agreement that allows both countries to work together to incorporate components and parts from one country being assembled in another or vice versa. And keep in mind, Kevin, as we talk about international trade and trade agreements nowadays, it's as much services as it is manufacturing. So.
Yes.
High tech obviously includes a lot of services, a lot of intellectual property and expertise that is also included in terms of coverage of the agreement.
Yeah,
Senator,
I think there's an increased opportunity in the market there, but I think it is important to note that we have an estimated 3.7 million manufacturing jobs that are supported by exports. And fully 27%, a quarter of all jobs in the manufacturing sector are involved in this export market.
Excellent. Well, Senator Lott, thanks for joining us on Capital Thinking. We're going to have you back sometime soon to talk SEC football, the important topics of the day.
Absolutely.
Frank, thanks as always for joining us. We're going to be back in just a minute to talk about the allegations against presidential candidate Herman Cain and what it means for you, sexual harassment in the workplace. Keep it right here on Capital Thinking.
The market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now toll free 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
What's your name worth? The loss of a single patent, trademark, or copyright can cost millions. Make sure your intellectual property is protected. Trust Patton Boggs to manage and protect your most important assets.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Are you looking for innovative ideas on how to achieve your financial dreams? Tune in to Empirical Investing Radio every Thursday afternoon at 2 Pacific, 5 Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel. Join certified financial planners Ken Smith and Ethan Broga to learn how you can obtain financial success. You'll be entertained while you discover techniques to alleviate your financial concerns. Empirical Investing Radio every Thursday at 2 Pacific, 5 Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel.
Technology is changing the way we live our lives and how we do business. On CIO Talk Radio, we talk about the benefits of technology and the great things it allows us to do, as well as its risks. Heard every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Central, 7 a.m. Pacific, Sunjo Gall interviews business leaders and other experts that are shaping the way we use technology. To learn more about the show, visit www.ciotalkradio.com. Keep up with the changing world of technology and listen to CIO Talk Radio with Sunjo Gall. Listen in every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Central, 7 a.m. Pacific, right here on Voice America Business.
The business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio, Voice America Business Network.
From Washington.
Washington. It's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right. Well, welcome back. You'd have to be living in a cave somewhere not to know that presidential candidate Herman Cain has been alleged to have been involved in a number of sexual harassment claims during his time running the National Restaurant Association back in the 90s. So we wanted to bring on one of our favorite guests, Doug Mishkin, a good friend of mine here at the firm and co-chair of the Patton Boggs Employment Law Practice Group. Doug, welcome back to the show. I have to think, as you see all these stories unfold, that a lot of HR directors are hearing from CEOs or other folks at the board level saying, hey, when was the last time we did an internal workshop on sexual harassment? Are we doing the right things? Do our people know what they're doing? So tell me, what should employers do at a time like this where there's an awful lot of attention being paid to sexual harassment in the workplace?
Well, Kevin, first I want to make clear that there are two kinds of cases that I do not discuss publicly. There are cases where I'm not personally familiar with the facts, and then the cases where I am. Having said that, I'm not familiar with the facts personally here. But as an employment lawyer, you know, this isn't so much a matter about an employer and an employee, but when allegations surface in a political context, you know, it has to be looked at through that kind of lens. So I have no judgment about whether the allegations do or do not have merit. Having said that, this kind of episode, I think, serves as a reminder to employers about being focused on the basics. Do you have a harassment policy that's clear and that's published to your employees? Do you train your people about these issues? Do you have a good complaint handling mechanism? Because we want to encourage employees who have legitimate complaints to make their complaint within the organization. And then do you discipline people appropriately for inappropriate conduct?
Doug, what's always fascinating for me about this stuff is the he said, she said nature of it all and how difficult it is if these are the only two people in the room, the only two people party to the conversation that leads to the allegations, how difficult it's got to be for an employer to unravel that and figure out what to do.
Well, it is difficult, although it's not impossible to sort out. And yes, this does occur frequently when allegations are made. The people who are charged with doing the investigations in the workplace ought to have training about how to do those investigations, because that training can help people sort out the he said, she said stuff. I tell my clients, just because it's a he said, she said situation does not necessarily mean that you cannot make a judgment about what you think happened. You may have to look for evidence in other places, like did the person who's making the complaint tell anyone else about what allegedly happened at the time it happened? That kind of thing can be corroborating evidence. Also, if there are a number of complaints about the so-called wrongdoer, that might be evidence that would help you sort out a he said, she said situation.
Interesting. Well, I know the other big thing when people talk about this case, you know, over dinner amongst friends, is what's it mean that the National Restaurant Association paid out to a couple of folks who made allegations? You know, the numbers are $35,000-$40,000 from the early 90s, and is that meaningful amount of money, or was that sort of go-away money? So can you make assumptions when you hear that there was these sort of agreements executed? Can you make assumptions about what conduct did and didn't occur?
I don't think you can. The fact that an agreement was entered into and that money was paid does not necessarily mean that there was merit to the allegations. Look, sometimes employers enter into such agreements and pay money because the allegations do have merit and you decide that it's appropriate to resolve the matter quickly rather than litigate. But sometimes the allegations have no merit and you decide as a business proposition for a variety of reasons that it makes better sense just to resolve the situation, pay some amount of money, and be done with it, and get a release by which the employee agrees not to, to bring any lawsuit. The dollar amounts involved can vary for all kinds of reasons.
Well, Doug, let me ask you, one of the things I think has frustrated a lot of people on the political right about this situation has been the anonymity of the accusers. The Politico newspaper, which launched this whole thing, basically ran with a story about a couple women who settled these cases against Kane and the National Restaurant Association, but didn't want to talk about the specifics and didn't want to be identified. And a lot of pushback in the blogosphere and elsewhere saying, well, you know, this is not a rape case. This is a sexual harassment case. And if you're going to try and take down a man who's literally running for the nation's highest office, you should at least be able to stand up and identify yourself and be subject to scrutiny. So talk to me a little bit about confidentiality here.
Well, confidentiality is complicated in this kind of situation. Again, without making a judgment about it, realize that there were agreements apparently entered into between the Restaurant Association and the employees, and now a third party, the press, comes along and shines a light on this. So it's not the the employees who signed the agreements and who agreed to confidentiality who brought it to public attention, but it's a third party. But confidentiality gets involved at various stages of the process because commonly, the person who makes the complaint wants confidentiality, and the employer typically responds and says, well, we can't promise total secrecy in investigating your complaint, but we can limit disclosure on a need-to-know basis. Then, if there is a settlement agreement, usually confidentiality is a term of that agreement, and in the garden variety situation, even that is hard to monitor. But when a situation like this arises, prompted by a third party disclosing the situation, that just makes confidentiality all the more difficult.
So Herman Cain's been stuck in the position of he's either lying about what's happened or he's trying to disprove a negative that, you know, that, hey, I didn't do this, but I can't really demonstrate to you that I didn't. So he's offering to take a lie detector test, which, you know, seems very interesting. And I'm wondering about the admissibility of that and whether or not that's the sort of thing employers would ever want to even ask of somebody in these types of cases.
No, employers, look, the interest of the employer may be different from the interest of the individual who is the subject of the allegation. But employers need to know that they should not be requiring or even requesting employees, whether the employee is alleging or denying the sexual harassment, an employer should not be requesting or requiring the people to take a lie detector test. The Federal Employee Polygraph Protection Act prohibits private employers from using polygraphs for such purposes. Having said that, employers do have other ways of trying to determine the credibility of people who are making the allegations or denying them.
We have ways of making you talk.
Well, and in the workplace, our way of making you talk is to say you're an employee here, you have an obligation to cooperate with us in our investigation, so please answer these questions. And then you have an opportunity to determine, is the person's story consistent? Are the allegations or the denials inherently plausible or implausible? What has shown up in the email traffic? Are there phone records that would be relevant? So there are all kinds of ways you can collect information and then make credibility determinations based on that.
Gotcha. Well, you know, one of the things that's been interesting about this is, of course, it drums up recollections of the Clarence Thomas confirmation hearings for the Supreme Court and
yeah.
Anita Hill making some very sensational charges that were as widely covered as things could be 20 years ago. And when you see that footage, it looks ancient. It's not in high def, and the suits don't look right, and the hairstyles don't look right. And I imagine when you look at that, you think that the workplace environment of 20 years ago isn't the workplace environment today where these types of things happen.
Well, that's certainly true in this sense. From an employment lawyer's perspective, a lot has changed because now, 20 years later, almost all companies, almost all organizations get the basics right in terms of having written policies that define what harassment is and telling employees what to do if they have a complaint. And many organizations have training for their managers and supervisors and for the rank and file employees. And the human resource people who are involved in this area know what harassment, sexual and otherwise, is, and more of them are trained how to do these investigations. So it's not to say that the problem of harassment generally and sexual harassment has been solved, but I think any fair observer of the workplace would say that it's a very different situation 20 years later.
Doug, I got just about 2 minutes left, so hit me with sort of the three key takeaways you'd want any employer you're advising to get out of this situation.
I'm really big on process, and I find that when a new case comes out or a high-profile situation like that, this hits the press, inevitably what I'm saying to clients is, let's stick to the basics. Are policies saying what they need to say? Are we training people properly, addressing situations at the level of, hey, this looks like inappropriate conduct, is a time-proven, cost-effective way to keep those situations from blowing up into something that's much more serious, that leads to litigation, that leads to time and expense.
Interesting. Very interesting. Well, it'll be, I think everyone's kind of curious to see how these allegations play themselves out in the context of a presidential campaign. And, like you said at the top, we are not familiar with the facts, but that doesn't mean that, everyone doesn't rush to judgment one way or another in all this. We've been joined by Doug Mishkin, the co-chair of the Patton Boggs Employment Law Practice Group. Doug, hit us with your email real fast for people who want to follow up with you.
It's DMISHKIN at PattonBoggs.com.
Great. Well, Doug, many thanks to having you on, and we'll try and have you back sometime later this year. We're going to be back in just a minute to talk about the status of the Super Committee. We'll have one of Washington's preeminent budget experts on to talk about what he thinks will happen with the Super Committee in the next 2 weeks. Until then, keep it here on Capital Thinking.
Markets up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now toll free 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs LLP.
From K Street to Wall Street to LaSalle Street, the Patton Boggs team knows how to pull off big business transactions. Come hear what we know. Patton Boggs covers the world.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Interrogatories.
Prima facie.
Pleadings.
Motion for summary judgment.
E-discovery.
Affirmative defense.
Stipulations.
Ex parte.
Amicus brief.
Subpoena.
Litigation is confusing. Trust the litigation team at Patton Boggs to make sense of it all.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than four decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
When it comes to business,
you'll find the experts here.
Voice America Business Network.
Live from
from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
Okay, well, the Super Committee is just 2 weeks away from having to reach a decision and present a plan to America to save an awful lot of money over the next decade, and the question is, are they going to get there or not? Our guest this segment, Stan Collender, a partner at Corvus Communications, somebody who spends a lot of time dealing in strategic communications regarding the public policy process, and someone with one of the more unique resumes in Washington, D.C., extensive experience serving both the House and Senate budget committees, working for three representatives who served on both the House Budget and Ways and Means Committee, and a guy I often read. He writes very regularly on budget issues for one of the big Washington publications here. So, Stan, welcome to the show. And optimist or pessimist, are we going to see a deal out of the Super Committee?
First of all, you didn't mention my most important credential. That is, I'm a former stand-up comedian, which is important when you're watching this stuff. I am a decided pessimist and have been since the day it was created. That is, I didn't see how this particular effort was going to be much different from or had, you know, much different pressures than all of the other failed efforts over the last year or so. So I'm thinking we're going to get to November 23rd, the date they're supposed to take a vote on a plan. And there may be a Democratic plan, a Republican plan. Each will get six votes, and nothing is going to happen.
Very interesting. So you see a lot of sort of buildup to the possibility that we're going to fail, Stan, in that now the leaks are not necessarily about trial balloons of we should do this or that, but about who's not being cooperative and who's trying to undermine the process. Like, oh, we're trying to make a deal, but those other guys aren't. So you know, there's also some sensing about, well, do we really have to have a deal in 2 weeks? So talk to me about that one first. Do you have
let's talk about a little bit about the process. The date is November 23rd. It's by that date the super committee, or as I call it, the not so super committee, is supposed to come up with and take a vote on a deficit reduction plan equal to, or at least reducing the deficit by somewhere between $1.2 and $1.5 trillion. They can do more, they're just not supposed to do less. They then are supposed to report that to the House and Senate by December 2nd, and both houses of Congress are supposed to vote on it without any amendments or without making any changes by Christmas. What happens if the Super Committee fails, or if Congress fails to enact what the Super Committee recommends, is that you get these automatic across-the-board cuts in spending. That is $1.2 trillion in spending cuts, half from defense and half from domestic. These cuts would be triggered. But, and this is the key thing, the cuts might be triggered in December, but they don't actually take place until January 2013. That is a year from now.
Yeah, and
immediate negative implications of this.
Yeah, I get the sense when you talk to the rank and file members, the people who aren't on the super committee, and frankly, the people who voted for this deal earlier this summer when the super committee was created, two growing realizations. One, this is no way to run a democracy to put 12 guys in a room and the rest of the elected representatives wait in here and get a single up and down vote. And two, you know, if you're going to make significant changes, this isn't the way to get the kind of buy-in that you want to make major structural changes to how we operate.
I think that's true in theory. In practice, you're probably never going to get a major deficit deal like this. If you give everybody a chance to have, you know, to amend it in some way, because if that's the case, every one of the 435 members of the House and 100 members of the Senate are going to want to do things a little differently. So one of the concepts here was, all right, it'll be constitutional, but we're going to truncate the process a little bit. I don't have any problem with that. I just don't think that the politics of deficit reduction are such that there's a lot of incentive for members to, you know, to go back on what they've promised their constituents. I don't see Republicans, for example, agreeing to big revenues. I don't see Democrats agreeing to big cuts in Medicare. And even if the other side agreed to do that unilaterally, I don't think that would induce the other side to go back on their what they promised their constituents and their base voters. So I'm fully expecting, one, the super committee to fail, two, that we're going to spend all of next year talking about how to avoid these across-the-board cuts. The president will submit a budget in February that he will say, you know, would eliminate the need for the cuts. Congress will pass a budget of its own that would avoid the cuts. And nothing is going to be decided until a lame duck session about a year from now.
Well, and that's the other thing I hear now from everyday members is that because the sequestration is for a date distant in the future, you're talking about these cuts over a decade, the number that might be imposed on the next fiscal year budget is actually relatively small, and they just don't feel like, hey, if we don't get a deal or if we vote against the deal and the deal fails, these cuts won't happen because, much like some other things, the sustainable growth rate, the doc fix, that sort of thing, we'll never let it happen. Future Congresses won't go through with it.
Yeah, and there's a lot, I agree, there's a lot of talk about that, that is, you can't bind future Congresses and that this would be a 10-year deal. That would be the worst of all possible outcomes as far as the financial markets are concerned. All the people I talk to on Wall Street, which is a major practice area for me, tell me that they don't really care whether the super committee comes up with $1.2 trillion in spending cuts or whether the across-the-board cuts, the sequester goes into effect and cuts spending by $1.2 trillion. One or the other is fine. Where they're going to get upset is if the super committee fails and then the other cuts are waived, ignored, reduced, eliminated. Somehow they don't happen, just as you were suggesting. That's the point at which you might get a very negative response from Wall Street. It's what could get a further downgrade of U.S. debt.
All right, so I'll ask you a question that was asked to me, Stan, by a friend over dinner. So, you know, their question is, gosh, we saw this big explosion of spending the last couple years of Bush and the first couple years of Obama. Why can't we just simply say, let's go back to what the federal government was spending in fiscal year 2008 or 2009, before the explosion, whichever year that was?
All right, first of all, the explosion, as this person is asking you, was mostly because of Afghanistan and Iraq spending and because of spending for on the bailouts and on the stimulus. Stimulus spending is over. The bailout spending is over. Iraq and Afghanistan is winding down. So tell me what you want to cut. In the meantime, interest on the debt has gone up because the government has borrowed more.
Right.
So the myth that we can just go back to 2008 without the government making substantial changes in what it does is, you know, because of these other things that are in place, is just not there. And it's a rational but not necessarily a practical way of thinking about it. Also, let's remember that more people are eligible for Medicare now and Social Security, and therefore spending goes up not because we've provided richer benefits but because more people are eligible for those programs. Now, if you want to tell me you want to change Medicare, fine. But, you know, I would also argue that we should be getting revenues back to the level they were in 2008 when they were about 18% of GDP. Now they're 14% of GDP. So, you know, you've got to do both, not just one side or the other.
Yeah, it is interesting. I do think that once you get away from the political extremists in both parties, that I think the vast majority of Americans recognize that you both have to raise revenue and reduce spending in order to fix the problem long term. And I sense there's just great frustration out there that this process isn't going to be as serious about that as they want. Well, I've got about 90 seconds left, Stan. Any other predictions or thoughts on what's going to happen with the super committee between now and December 23rd at midnight?
I think we're going to hear a lot of smoke, as you suggested earlier, a lot of finger pointing about they're the reasons this isn't happening. Keep in mind that in some respects, politically at least, the best thing that could happen would be for the super committee to fail, since most folks, Wall Street and others, don't have high expectations for it. And for Democrats and Republicans to have an issue going into next year, the election year, rather than have deficit reduction. That's what they think is the best, and we'll see whether that actually works out politically.
Great. Well, we've been joined by Stan Collender from Corvus. Stan, you want to hit us with your email address for people who want to follow up with you?
It's S. Collender, C-O-L-L-E-N-D-E-R, at Corvus, Q-O-R, V as in Victor, IS.com. Thanks for asking.
Stan, many thanks. Great show here on Capital Thinking. We hope everyone has a great weekend. We'll be back next week with more Capital Thinking here on the Voice America Business Network.
Thank you for joining us for Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. We hope to have you join us again for more insight from Washington. We're here every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Business Network.
What do you think of the price of gas these days?
I can't take this!
How'd you like to never have to pay for gas again? Ever?
Yes!
Join a group that helps people save money and make money at the same time. We save money by giving a 10% rebate at the pump based on the average person spending $50 per week. That's $5 per week times 52 weeks or $260. That's right. You can save $260 per year with our membership, plus get paid for referring other members. Earn $25 for just referring two members, and you'll continue to get paid $25 for every two members that are referred by members on your team. You'll get paid daily. That's right. Get paid on your Global Gas Card Visa card every day. The maximum you can earn is $3,000 per day, 7 days per week. This is literally $1 million program. $3,000 per day times 30 days is $90,000 per month. $1,080,000 per year.
Wow.
Plus, the GGC membership has many other benefits, such as gas tabs that can increase gas mileage by 10 to 15%. Unlimited cell phone and text for $40 per month with no contract. A discount pharmacy and travel program and much, much more. All for $150, a one-time only charge. To enroll, simply go to www.vagas.globalgascard.com. That's vagas.globalgascard.com.
Hey, did you know Voice America has partnered with the Kidstar Network to expand their reach through Voice America Kids? Voice America Kids will feature talk radio for kids by kids, along with special event programming and live broadcasts. Each program is conveniently archived for on-demand listening at any time. Please check our archives for the latest events and happenings on voiceamericakids.com.
Some great ideas arise on their own. Others need a little help getting off the ground. That's where BB&T comes in. From supporting local schools and the arts, to helping small businesses, or just lending a hand, we provide the lift our communities need to grow. And with a good start in the right direction, there's no limit to where we can go. Banking, insurance, investments, BB&T. Best bank in town since 1872.
Member FDIC. Only deposit products are FDIC insured.
In the spirit of Have Couch, Will Travel, Dr. Carol Lieberman creates a haven of sanity in an increasingly insane world. Each day we are bombarded with news of events that have never crossed our wildest nightmares. Society is spiraling out of control and everyone is reeling from it. But now there's an answer. The best way to keep sane in this insane world is to tune in to Dr. Carol's Couch on Voice America. Dr. Carol, a certified media psychiatrist, will broadcast live from her Beverly Hills office every Tuesday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time. Call or log in and get help with whatever is sending you reeling whenever you need a soothing voice to calm and advise you. That's Dr. Carol's Couch every Tuesday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time here on America's Voice, voiceamerica.com.
Now there's a new destination for video content, VoiceAmerica.tv, just like our radio channels and so much more. Voice America Variety, Health and Wellness, Business, Sports, Green Talk, Power Up Motorsports, and Seventh Wave Network now have their own video channel components. Plus, check out exclusive programming, including movies, music, educational courses, science and history, current events, and short features. High-definition, premier-quality programs available 24/7. VoiceAmerica.tv. If you think you've seen online TV like this before, let us surprise you.
Being here with Ariel and Shia Kane is an ordinary person's guide to modern-day enlightenment. This show is an exciting exploration which opens the door to living in the moment. Don't miss being here. Tune in every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Pacific, 12 noon Eastern with Ariel and Shia Kane right here on the Seventh Wave Network.
Holistic living is nutrition for not just your body, but your mind and your soul. Holistic nutrition goes far beyond the foods that we eat or the supplements that we take. Discover natural means to heal your body and regain your innate healing powers. That's Holistic Living with Tina Marie Jones on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel, live every Tuesday at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern. Tune in for your weekly dose of good holistic living.
What would you do if you knew that you could not fail? The Dr. Pat Show with Dr. Pat Basile is a radio forum for some of the world's most influential people in the fields of health, wellness, and human potential. Dr. Pat brings together and introduces visionary scientists and futurists, environmentalists, educators, business leaders, inventors, filmmakers, authors, artists, mystics, and healers who inspire and support individual and collective growth and positive cultural shifts. This award-winning radio show empowers the listening community to be the change they want to see in the world. Tune in every Thursday at 8 a.m. Pacific for the Dr. Pat Show with Dr. Pat Basile, radio to thrive by.
In the spirit of Have Couch, Will Travel, Dr. Carol Lieberman creates a haven of sanity in an increasingly insane world. Each day we are bombarded with news of events that have never crossed our wildest nightmares. Society is spiraling out of control and everyone is reeling from it. But now there's an answer. The best way to keep sane in this insane world is to tune in to Dr. Carol's Couch on Voice America. Dr. Carol, a certified media psychiatrist, will broadcast live from her Beverly Hills office every Tuesday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time. Call or log in and get help with whatever is sending you reeling whenever you need a suit.
Where do you stand as a leader? Are there things you would change about your business or organization? Welcome to What's Leadership Got to Do with It with your host, Rick Thiemann. Together, we'll explore the five dynamics that exist in every workplace, as well as answer some of your leadership questions. Now, here's your host, Rick Thiemann.
Hey, good afternoon for those of you who are on the East Coast, and good morning for those still on the West Coast. My name's Rick Thiemann. I'm your host for the day. On this show, What's Leadership Got to Do with It? My firm is called The Executive Group. I've been in business for about 20 years, and have worked in various aspects of the business world. And last week's show was on fundamental components of leadership, the basics of leadership, and today's program is a continuation of that. And my guest on this show is Dr. Dave Watterson, who was a guest not too long ago when we did a show on called Making Sense of Testing. And Dr. Watterson and I are going to talk about some of the things that he has worked on and I've worked on with him and worked on together in terms of leadership. And kind of today's leadership component piece, just going to talk about kind of the leadership passage and how you kind of move your leaders along and some of the things that go into leadership development. So welcome, Dr. Dave. Great to have you back again.
Well, it's very nice to be back. And I think this is a really important topic because, as you say, you use the word passage, but it's a passage, it's a journey, it's a process, and I know you've certainly played an active part in that process with the leaders that you've worked with over the years, and it certainly is a rewarding process, but also a fairly complex one.
I think it's a lot more complex than most people realize, and I know that until I began to really study the world of leadership, I didn't realize its complexity. And of course, some things you can make overly complex that you don't need to. But for those of you who are listening today, if you've listened to last week's show, you know we got into the six fundamental component pieces of the strong leadership process, leadership program, and those six fundamental things were a strong business model, being able to have a degree of what the competencies are necessary to map to that business model. We spoke about the third piece is a strong assessment process, which we're going to go into further today. The fourth piece is a strong feedback mechanism that really gives tough, hard-hitting, tough love back to the executive. The fifth one is the accountability factor to make people hold themselves accountable to continue through rather than just kind of a checklist of things that I did in terms of I did my MBO, I did my 360, so to speak. And then the last piece is that what's the ongoing development that continues that process. But the reason I've asked Dave back on the phone is because he has done a tremendous amount of work in the world of leadership, especially using the 16PF and other component instruments. And we're going to tie in assessments and behavior and personality and leadership as kind of the mix of today's show. And I'm going to ask Dave here in a second to kind of speak to what we call the passage of leadership. Dave has developed a very interesting pyramid model that focuses on kind of the evolution, the stages of leadership, and I'd like him to speak to. But it's about being able to help leaders become aware. And the premise of the book, What's Leadership Got to Do with It, really isn't about leadership per se, as these last two shows, or that last show and this show has been. The premise of the book, What's Leadership Got to Do with It, is the fundamental five things that I think a leader has to pay attention to. So there's no chapter in the book about leadership. Maybe there probably should be. But the book is based on the fundamental principles that leaders have to pay attention to. But in this show today, we're going to talk about what leaders need to pay attention to at a personal level, as well as what organizations need to pay attention to from a business level to help kind of drive that. So, Dave, when we talk about the passages of leadership or the evolution of leadership and the model that you've created, which is a very intriguing model, if you'd speak to that, just to kind of give people an idea of where we're headed with our conversation today.
Well, when you spoke to the personal level, what you and I have paid attention to for years is the resources that you have as an individual. If you can't access them clearly and well, and Shannon last week spoke very nicely to the importance of context, the strengths that you have are not strengths or weaknesses until you pay attention to the context and the situation. What we did with the model was to pay attention to how, as you continue to grow, you need to reference who you are and what your resources are to the situation. So the model starts with your core values, which is also important for the organization to identify and go through. So, for instance, the elements in the core values might be, and each organization can determine it for themselves, but often it's customer service, quality, integrity, innovation, respect for others, those kinds of values, which are core values. And then you step into the specific work skills that you have, be it around computers, engineering, a business segment that you're working with, like the supply chain. And you need to know the specifics that are connected to the business and the business awareness. Those are the specific skill matrix pieces. If it's in manufacturing, it's lean manufacturing, those components. And that's just the knowledge that you need, and that's at a base level. Often that's the primary pieces where a person steps into an organization early on. I've had the fortunate advantage of being with organizations for a long period of time, and have seen individuals come in, develop some core competencies, skills. And then when we start speaking to competencies, we often have that related to the what commonly is used as the term emotional intelligence, which simply has to do with the clarity of knowing yourself, managing yourself well, understanding how that works with others, and then being able to use that in the effective relationships that you build in an organization that really account tremendously for your success in working with teams and communicating and in influencing across the organization. Those are all the key components that start to build as you have an individual role in an organization. As you move into management and then leadership, and I tend to like to make some distinctions between those two. Managing is really much more about the paying attention, how you staff an organization, how you manage and measure work, hold others accountable, and pay attention to the business results. That's the transactional piece of doing the business. And then as you step into the real leadership role where you start managing managers, you're going to end up paying attention to the coaching of those people, engaging them with inspiring vision, and really exercising some good business acumen around the strategic thinking that you're doing.
Well, and so let's talk then to the component piece of maybe even the Peter principle as that evolves, and that people get promoted beyond their level of skill sets or abilities. But is it true then that high performing people usually are reluctant to change because they go back to what got them there and what makes them the most comfortable and what they know? And they need to learn to shift from doing the work to getting work done through others.
Well, as Shannon talked about yesterday with our last session, the change of context. So as you go from managing yourself to managing others, the competence that you have at getting work done through yourself, and so for instance, your success in understanding how to do the scheduling for an organization, if you're in a schedule role, and your attention to detail and how you handle those details as you then are managing a group of schedules, it's critical for you to be able to shift your context, your orientation to that work, so you're paying attention to the people doing the work rather than the work itself. And then your tendency to possibly micromanage would start showing up. Now, that might be that it's just a matter of starting to get awareness for your strength in controlling details is not going to be helpful when you are looking to inspire others or pay attention to simply keeping them focused and motivated. That'll be different than you attending to all the details. So sometimes it's just a matter of shifting the attention and giving feedback to the individual so that they can start to let go of what got them where they were successful in one role, but not at the next role.
It's like moving from a superintendent role and a plant manager to an operations manager to then a logistics manager to the plant manager then to the regional operations manager. But, you know, as you look at and kind of talking about what you talk about managing self and then managing others and then managing managers and then becoming that business unit manager or that group manager or even an enterprise manager, the levels that you go through and the shifts and changes in your values and your core responsibilities and your thinking style needs to change and evolve as you go, and many leaders don't make that transition.
Oh, absolutely, and I'd certainly emphasize the thinking style piece, your ability to look at a much broader context rather than the details and the specifics. It also means that and Shannon nicely spoke to the ability to be able to stretch so that you can pay attention to details when they're pertinent, and then when they are not, you can let go of them and look at the bigger picture and not just stay in the details. So your ability to stretch, in this case, your thinking and conceptual skills is really critical. And if you're too rigid or too detailed and not able to shift, then you end up not being able, you used the term Peter principle, you are then unsuccessful at the next higher level. Even though you might have been the absolutely best at what you did at the earlier level.
Yeah, so a great marketing manager who really understands the world of marketing, as he gets into that enterprise manager role, he then begins to move his efforts back toward marketing if he feels that's the gap in the organization. And then when you look at some leaders in the organization who are say come up to become president, CEO, who is a former accountant or controller, well, guess what the focus is of the business? Or the operations manager who becomes president, or the sales manager who becomes president, and guess what happens to the mindset of those organizations based on kind of the mental background of where that person's been, other than spreading and looking at things from a broader perspective?
The term learning agility has certainly showed up in much of the current literature, and it speaks to that piece of being able to broaden out your way of conceptualizing the level that you're responsible for.
So as we've kind of just opened up the show and as we get ready to kind of go into the rest of the show, we're trying to set the stage for understanding the components of what, you know, moves things along in the world of leadership. And when we come back from the break, as we get ready to take our next break, we're going to get into personality and competencies. And there's a number of competency models out there. Dave's developed one called the Leadership Competency Inventory that we use. It's a great tool. But we're going to talk about, when we come back in the break, we're going to talk about personality, competencies, and the common dimensions of personality in successful leaders. You're listening to What's Leadership Got to Do with It? I'm your host, Rick Thiemann, with my guest, Dr. Dave Watterson, also a very esteemed business colleague I worked with for almost 20 years in my work. Dave's background encompasses well over 40, and we're going to talk more as we move forward about leadership and as we move into this next segment. You can check us out at the web at www.theeg.com or call us at 866-472-5790 if you've got questions, or email us at rick@theeg.com. I'm looking forward to having you back after the break.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here.
Voice America Business Network.
20 years of research shows us that 20 to 25% of an organization's sales force is underwater. A salesperson selling at 75% of quota is costing you at least $5,000, including opportunity costs. Our program, Developing Sales Force Effectiveness, shows you how to manage these underperformers more effectively. Improving the sales effectiveness of just two salespeople will give you a 100% return on investment. For more information, visit the Executive Group website at www.theeg.com.
Tune in every Tuesday at 8 a.m. Pacific Time for The Growth Strategist with Aldana Ambler. On the show, Aldana and some of today's top business professionals will discuss some of today's most pressing business issues that hold you, the business owner, back. Aldana will also give you 21 ways to grow with her list of growth strategies. Grow smart, grow profit, and grow your business with Aldana Ambler and The Growth Strategist every Tuesday at 8 a.m. Pacific Time, right here on the Bottom Line in Business Talk, Voice America Business.
For the past 20 years, the Executive Group has helped organizations recruit, select, train, develop, and coach their most valuable asset, their people. Whether entry-level or top leadership, the Executive Group uses a variety of tools considered to be the gold standard in assessments and development to provide insight and direction to help our clients show the greatest return on their most valuable investment. For more information on how the Executive Group can help you link strategic intent with human capital, visit our website at www.theeg.com.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You are listening to What's Leadership Got to Do with It, featuring your host, Rick Thiemann. If you have a question or comment about today's program, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or send an email to assessment@theeg.com. Now, back to Rick Thiemann.
Hey, welcome back to the show. What's Leadership Got to Do with It? You're listening to myself and Dr. Dave Watterson. And in this segment of the show, we're going to get into personality and competencies and what common dimensions of behavior are critical in successful leaders and how we can do. And in the third session, we'll move to more of the assessment roles to be able to identify that from a pure self-development level. But Dave, speak to the fact of personality and how a personality impacts the competency, or perhaps even, which we're going to talk about in the fourth segment, about derailers, how personality plays a huge factor in a person's ability to really establish a strong, specific competency.
Well, there's been quite a bit of conversation about, is personality the same as competence, and the confusion around, we're talking about behaviors in both circumstances. So if you're influencing, there are certain personalities that influence probably better than others. But whether you're particularly dominant, which is more of a personality characteristic, or not, the way you influence, you can still be influential and not necessarily be terribly dominant. But you need to learn that, which is goes back to what you've talked about before, is the criticalness of understanding yourself and the self-awareness piece. So finding out what your personality is assists you to be able to then start to shape and develop your abilities to influence, which is one of the competencies that we use in the list of competencies associated around good leadership. So understanding your dominance, and I like to speak constantly to the effect of the importance of balance. So a little of something could be good. A lot may not be better. To be reasonably dominant, meaning that you like to have a strong hand in controlling or directing a situation, doesn't mean that if you're extremely dominant that it's not much better. So it really depends on the context, the set of circumstances, and your understanding when to increase or decrease that element of your personality to be able to fit it, situational appropriateness, to the set of circumstances. That's why it's so nice to see that, for instance, in influence, dominance is important. Certainly having an awareness of what's going on around you and paying attention to that, liking to move things forward, looking for change, and the ability to manage effectively change, both inspire it as well as keep it on course. And certainly the ability to do all that with a good degree of integrity will give you an idea of how well you're able to show up in your capacity to influence. We have taken competencies and then used the measures that we have, the 360 measures around competence, and we've also then mapped that to the personality dimensions to see what key personality elements are relative to each of the competencies. The capacity to demonstrate empathy is certainly connected to much of the ability to effectively coach and support others. And there are a number of other personality dimensions connected with the competencies that as somebody is able to learn that, they become that much more effective in their leadership.
So when you look at competencies across a broad spectrum, it's a person's ability to be able to differentiate their personality and behavioral tendencies, such as if I'm a very conservative individual who doesn't like risk, and I'm very structured and very practical and very pragmatic and very systematic and very methodical, and that's my general personality, the behaviors in it emerge as I am challenged with growing an enterprise or setting strategic direction or reestablishing a strategic initiative, then what happens to my ability to do that, Dave, if I'm that structured, conservative person who doesn't like risk?
Well, you're going to have a tendency to overanalyze and spend too long looking at the limitations of something, and it will be difficult for you to establish a balance in it. That would be the most likely predictor of how you're going to step into that situation. Somebody that knows that, if they're going to step into that, can either augment that with somebody to challenge them to pay attention to that issue, which can certainly assist in being able to get through and navigate that circumstance without the downfalls of over-exercising that personality tendency.
Well, so then based on that, and I'll just throw out a statement, and that is that, or at least a concept or an idea for people to think about and for us to explore as we wrap up the second segment, but is it possible to grow leaders unless you really have strong identification of what your competencies need to be, and also for people to understand the shifts they need to make to be more successful in a leadership role and be able to have a way to get the feedback, if you will, on where they're perhaps falling short?
Well, I think it's critical that an organization take, for instance, a list of competencies. They can use any of the lists of competencies and identify for each of those segments of the business what are the key competencies that are critical to success. And that therein, as an individual steps into that with their own assessment of themselves, they can match up which ones are going to line up well with that core set of competencies that are seen as significant and which ones are going to be contraindicated. In those situations where you can see that your strength is going to be a weakness in this situation, you can start learning at either compensating for it or developing those competencies better so that you're not just going in and get blindsided and then try to scramble to learn those competencies.
So to the point that we established in last week's show, we talked about the six fundamental things that are critical in terms of having a successful leadership program, which is why we spoke to the fact of really understanding what your business model is and what your business drivers are and what your strategic intent really is, and then being able to line up those competencies are going to help you accomplish that. For example, if you've got a football team and your strategy is to run the ball, but you don't have any running backs or any tailbacks, it's just,
right.
You know, it's not going to work. So when you look at deploying talent and identifying talent and the whole piece around succession planning versus talent development, I think some people get confused on recognizing that understanding how to fill the pipeline is different from a succession planning program.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also continuing to not only monitor it, but also be able to, the piece that you speak to and the organization's first step is to understand what their business model or business strategy, in the business strategies coming out of that. And that way you can align your talent with those business strategies and not have them out of sync.
So David, session we talked about making sense of testing, one of the new assessments that you developed has an expatriate scale. And as you look at even going further into leadership development and expansion of leaders, when now then you take it to another level and you look at an expatriate assignment and the challenges that come into working in a country such as France versus a company such as China or even Germany. And again, it takes it to another level, does it not?
Oh, yes. Well, again, there you have another context, and it's very advantageous to say, given my nature, given the nature of the role that I'm going to play in the business and the culture that I'm going to be in, what are going to be the challenges that I can anticipate? How can I prepare for them and modify what it is that I do so that I don't end up being overly surprised?
So I remember asking one executive that I was being asked to interview and evaluate for a position in Europe, and I asked a very simple question. I said, how much time have you spent really understanding the culture you're going to go work in? And what do you think his response was? I didn't even think about that.
Yes, very little.
So, and of course,
paying a lot of attention to the role is typically what happens, and seeing the effect that it's going to have and working with those around them as well as within the culture sometimes gets overlooked.
So as we look then, there's got to be a way for an individual to provide that or to obtain that strong feedback to be able to help them start to engage their brain, if you will, in terms of where they're going and what they're doing and what shifts they need to make in terms of who they are and moving from supervision to management to leadership. And then as you move into various levels of leadership, the transition of all that as it evolves, there's got to be a way to have a strong feedback loop and a way to assess an individual's talent besides just performance reviews. And Dave, you've spent a lot of work looking at behaviors of leaders, and a lot of that work is, most of that work has been done through your use of the 16PF, which was the listeners who have come to listen to the show, they'll know that that's kind of a staple for us, is that particular behavioral model that we use, personality traits. But as we look at that, we're going to come back and speak more to that, but I've got about a minute or so before we go to break, but let's just talk real quick about assessments as a means of being able to help that leader drive that knowledge base for themselves.
Well, it's an interactive process, and we'll talk about that a little bit more, but it's the further fleshing out an understanding of how who we are, in this case, in our personality, meshes with the things that we do within the competencies, the behavioral context within the business.
So we're going to get ready to go to break here. You're listening to What's Leadership Got to Do With It. I'm your host, Rick Thiemann. You can check us out on the web at www.theeg.com, or you can send us an email at rick@theeg.com and answer your questions, or for Dr. Watterson. We've been talking about competencies in this particular segment. Dr. Watterson has developed a very robust outline called the Leadership Competency Inventory that we've adopted with our clients. It's a great tool for those who want to understand more about what a competency really looks like. We spoke last week about what we did with Shannon at Corporate Express and their competencies and how we linked development and personality back to the competencies. And when we come back from the break, we're going to talk about our role as consultants or executive coaches, if you will, and our role in terms of how we help facilitate the awareness around that executive for a greater outcome. So we'll see you back after the break.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
For the past 20 years, the Executive Group has helped organizations recruit, select, train, develop, and coach their most valuable asset, their people. Whether entry-level or top leadership, the Executive Group uses a variety of tools considered to be the gold standard in assessments and development to provide insight and direction to help our clients show the greatest return on their most valuable investment. For more information on how the Executive Group can help you link strategic intent with human capital, visit our website at www.theeg.com. 20 years of research shows us that 20 to 25% of an organization's sales force is underwater. A salesperson selling at 75% of quota is costing you at least $5,000, including opportunity costs. Our program, Developing Sales Force Effectiveness, shows you how to manage these underperformers more effectively. Improving the sales effectiveness of just two salespeople will give you a 100% return on investment. For more information, visit the Executive Group website at www.executivegroup.com.
theeg.com.
No family can survive on two incomes anymore, let alone one. If you are supplementing your family's income working from home, then tune into The Cash Flow Show, Direct Sales Radio. Host Deb Bixler brings you sales tips, lead generation systems, and best business practices that guarantee direct sales success. Whether you're looking for a little extra cash or a career change, The Cash Flow Show, Direct Sales Radio will give you proven systems that will work in your home business. The Cash Flow Show. Every Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, 5 p.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
You are listening to What's Leadership Got to Do with It, featuring your host, Rick Thiemann. If you have a question or comment about today's program, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or send an email to assessment@theeg.com. Now, back to Rick Thiemann.
Hey, welcome back, and thanks for listening in to What's Leadership Got to Do with It. The program was founded off the idea of writing the book that hopefully will be ready for publishing end of December. But the book is also called What's Leadership Got to Do with It. It's based on 20 years of consulting and 10 years of personal ownership in business and 10 years of work in the corporate world and international world. And fundamental things I think are critical for businesses that most leaderships, a lot of the leaders don't pay attention to. It's in the fundamental five I speak to in the book are what's your corporate culture? Number two, what do your individual contributors look like and how are you developing them? Chapter three is about group dynamics and how groups need to play well together to be able to execute. Chapter four is about your strategic intent and your business plan and your business initiative, and that hope is not a business plan and a budget is not a business plan. And then chapter five is about the structure that you need to operate your business in a way that allows you to go to market quickly and ease of doing business are critical things that leaders need to pay attention to. But as I mentioned, there's no chapter in the book about leadership per se, because that's what leaders need to look at. But last week's show and this week's show is about leadership and what it takes to be successful in leadership. And we were going to come back from the break and talk about kind of the assessment process that Dave uses and what I use. And the battery of assessments that go into and the process that goes into that whole assessment and that whole feedback loop that comes into play. So Dave's done a lot of work in the world of leadership for 40 years. I've done 20 years worth. And the research and things that we have been able to allow us the luxury of really seeing things play out from a personality standpoint. And, of course, the 16 PF that I spoke to helps us do that at a much deeper level than your typical assessment such as a Myers-Briggs or maybe a Caliper or some of the others that are on the market. So, Dave, if you'd speak to kind of the assessment value and specifically the 16 PF and the WPI that you've created in its approach.
Well, as we've talked about, the importance of looking at the context and then identifying the key competencies helps you identify the ideal or the preference and the key strengths, competency strengths that it's important to have. And then when you're going to then say, how do I match up to that, it's valuable to use an effective means of assessing that has attention to the aspects to who you are. And we as individuals certainly aren't simple. And so it's important to have an instrument that can measure that in a reliable manner and one that's been validated in a number of different business circumstances. It's good to have one that's been around for a long time and has a lot of good solid validities to a wide range of applications. That gives you the capacity to then see what match to the target that you're looking at, what areas would be beneficial to gain added training, and then most importantly, the experiences that will assist you in really learning what you're going to need to learn to perform effectively in that target range. It's really the development cycle is pay attention to the target, assess yourself with a reliable instrument, come up with the areas and identify the key one or ones that can be then paid attention to. Pay attention to the situation or set of experiences that will be key to learn, and then go into that situation. One of the things that I know that you do, and certainly I do, is not only provide the feedback as far as where somebody stands and direct them, give them some guidance towards taking accountability for learning new behaviors or stretching the behaviors that they have, but it's also helping them look back at that set of experiences to really see what they've learned and how they can go forward from that, independent of necessarily whether it's always been 100% successful or not. A lot of the learning that we get is when we look back and discover things that didn't go so well and can see what to do differently that would allow us to be even that much more effective.
Well, to that point, and where I was headed with that is when you look at the breadth and depth of some instruments versus other instruments, speaking specifically to the 16PF and compare it to, let's say, a Myers-Briggs or predictive index, which each only possess four dimensions of personality, where the 16PF factors in 15, the one of them being problem-solving or thinking skills. But there are literally 15 different behaviors across a spectrum of five broad ranges to include emotional intelligence and emotional resilience that a lot of instruments don't pick up. And when you look at executive assessment and executive evaluation using not only the 16PF but maybe even a battery of assessments to help identify, you know, true strengths across the emotional intelligence, emotional resilience, your deep-seated personality issues, and thinking skills.
Mm-hmm. Well, and therein, you know, again, points to the depth of who we are as individuals and the importance of using an instrument that can fully embrace that, keeping in mind that then it's a reducing it down into the key linked focus areas that will give you the most benefit relative to who you are and assist you to see how to apply that in the situations where it'll be most valuable.
So, and then a deeper dive then, excuse me, it's the 360 feedback that pulls in the competencies. So that now in a true feedback loop system, where most organizations simply rely on a 360 for its imperative feedback, when you tie in assessments and you tie in the biodata from a person's background and you tie in the 360 feedback of what other people see from the competencies and the behavioral things that emerge, and you provide a level of interviews that really gets at the heart of people being able to talk about or reveal certain maybe uncomfortable or unpopular things to say that may not be pulled out in the 360 that you do in individual interviews, the richness then that you get really allows then you to go forward. So when you look at then, you know, gentlemen like Dave and myself and even other consultants, you know, our role in organizations is to help facilitate learning and awareness. And the tools that we use are sometimes of question with certain people because they're not familiar with the 16PF. They are familiar with the Myers-Briggs. But most people are very familiar with the 360. And in most cases, most 360s really don't yield the benefit. But when they're used as a sole component piece to leadership, or it's used as a checklist for leaders, then the leadership piece goes nowhere. So what's been your experience with that, Dave?
Well, as with many things, the more you use a variety of feedback mechanisms, the increased likelihood is that the individual will be faced with the key areas that will most contribute to their growth. And that's given that they're willing to address it, and the organization then provides them with the support to not only learn it from a either course or training, but also put them in a set of experiences that will allow them to really do that. Sometimes it's almost the organization's willingness to put them into a situation that might not be catering to their strength, but ironically would be a key learning area for them to actually then develop what it is they're really going to need at the next higher level.
So when you look at then pulling together, you know, all those component pieces, a battery of assessments, not just in our battery we will use for an executive's assessment, we will probably use and incorporate the 16PF, Dave's Watterson personality inventory. We may use the Hogan in there. The Hogan's, we're going to talk more to derailers in the last segment, but where people kind of get upside down. But we'll also use the Watson-Glaser, which measures critical thinking skills from inductive-deductive reasoning. We'll use a Thurston test of mental alertness, which incorporates in then your cognitive ability. We'll use a spatial relationships measurement that looks at innate intelligence. And we'll use a number of different personality tools to really look at a person's broader scope. So when you add those component pieces and you add in then the person's behavior, they speak to the behavioral aspect of what you're trying to help an executive understand by doing a battery that's that in depth that, again, many organizations don't usually utilize.
Well, you're able to bring as best as possible some key measures of the I've referred to it earlier in the show, the resources that an individual has. You are the enterprise, and you bring that to the job, to the leadership challenge that you have in front of you. The 360 provides at least some of the feedback to individuals, which allows them to hear how those resources get played out in a general context, or actually a very specific set of contexts related to that job. And shaped to the leadership challenge that they have. We in the 360, it can be shaped to the organization, if and even to the division or the type of the business that it's directed to, in order to bring out how well they're actually performing to the criteria of the organization. And so you can see here
to that.
Resources brought. Here's how it plays out, and here are the adjustment areas that would be most beneficial to pay attention to.
So in other words, if we have a 360 and the things that we're looking to evaluate that person on from a 360 standpoint aren't really aligned with what the competencies are you want them to develop, you're really not comparing apples to apples then, are you?
No, of course not. And you'll get sawdust instead of applesauce, I guess.
So when we look at the 360 process, it maps back to the thing we talk about of one of the fundamental components of a successful leadership program, and that is if you don't have a clearly established set of competencies and or values, and you're not aligning that with the leadership expectations, and you're not measuring that against the leader's ability to deliver to the model, then really you're not helping that executive learn to grow, and you're not really focusing on the competencies necessary for success as you've defined in your organization. So as we wrap up this segment, you're listening to What's Leadership Got to Do with It with my guest, Dr. Dave Watterson, also a very esteemed colleague, and we worked together on a number of situations that have been just a great learning experience for me to tap into this gentleman's knowledge. And we are going to take a quick break and come back, and we're going to wrap up the show talking about derailers and, you know, what gets an executive upside down and, you know, and the unfortunate thing where interventions come into play and an executive gets in trouble and winds up losing their job, not because of their technical experience, but because of their lack of the soft skills or some of the business skills that they need to have. So we'll see you back after the break.
Business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio, Voice America Business Network.
If you currently or aspire to serve on a board or work in a leadership capacity for or with a public or nonprofit organization, where can you turn to get the best advice and practices? How about Leadership Matters with Dr. G? Our program discusses challenges facing both public and nonprofit leaders. Don't miss these practical solutions and tips to enhance your leadership style and effectiveness. Leadership Matters with Dr. G airs live Wednesdays at 2 p.m. Pacific, 5 p.m. Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel.
For the past 20 years, the Executive Group has helped organizations recruit, select, train, develop, and coach their most valuable asset, their people. Whether entry-level or top leadership, the Executive Group uses a variety of tools considered to be the gold standard in assessments and development to provide insight and direction to help our clients show the greatest return on their most valuable investment. For more information on how the Executive Group can help you link strategic intent with human capital, visit our website at www.theeg.com.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here.
Voice America Business Network.
You are listening to What's Leadership Got to Do with It, featuring your host, Rick Thiemann. If you have a question or comment about today's program, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or send an email to assessment@theeg.com. Now, back to Rick Thiemann.
Hey, welcome back to the show. You're listening to What's Leadership Got to Do with It.